And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show. It is Wednesday, November 29th. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, Britt Giroli from left to right across your screen. If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to like this video, subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't done so already. If you're listening to the podcast version of the show, drop us a 5-star review. Makes us happy, makes us feel good, makes our bosses happy as well. Happy Winter Meetings Eve to both of you. Are you excited about Nashville?
I like Nashville. You know, one thing that I have planned, and I have this on the thing, is I'm staying Wednesday night, so I don't always stay Wednesday night. And because Wednesday afternoon is like the Rule 5 draft, and that's kind of the end of the winter meetings. But I'm staying Wednesday night, and I'm planning on going out and seeing some live music, because Nashville is a great place to see live music. And last time the winter meetings were in Nashville, we went to the Opryland and went out to some bars that had sweet live music going. So I want to recreate some of that action. I do not like the place that the winter meetings is at in Nashville. It's like super huge. You get lost. It's kind of hard to like, one of the things you really want at the winter meetings is like everybody in one place.
Yeah.
And that place has like 10 bars, you know? So it's like, where are you? That's a lot of
what
the winter meetings in Nashville is. Where are you?
Totally. I will say that, like, I'm doing an agent survey for The Athletic, and we should have, you know, more than a dozen agents, and everyone agrees with, you know, that the premise of the winter meetings people like, but everyone wants to be in San Diego because there was one lobby, one way in, one way out. You knew if you were waiting on a GM or waiting on someone that they kind of had to walk in this way, whereas the Opryland is basically its own zip code. There's so many ins and outs and places. And I feel like by the time we are getting ready to leave, you know, I finally know like how to get to my room or how to get places.
Yeah, right.
It's a and it's like to too lost. Late, time to go home. You know, like I have wandered around aimlessly there. Wear comfortable shoes. If anyone who's listening has never been to a winter meetings, there's a lot of job seekers. It's an eclectic mix. I do really enjoy the first day. I enjoy seeing people. I like when there's a lot of news, but guys, unfortunately, people are kind of thinking this is going to be a dud. Because if Ohtani doesn't sign, and we know that Yamamoto is waiting on teams, he's going to Zoom with teams starting after the winter meetings, then those are two huge dominoes that need to fall. So this may be kind of a dud of a time in Nashville in terms of signings.
One thing that I'm wondering about, and I saw this, so Lance Lynn signed 1-for-12, right? And that's not a big deal. But it's like, well, if you're going to get 1-for-12 offers, then you just pick a team and you go. Right. Like you're not like Lance Lynn doesn't care about what Shohei Ohtani's getting. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking, well, who actually is waiting for Shohei Ohtani to sign? There's nobody else in Shohei Ohtani's class. There's nobody's like, well, Ohtani's going to set the market and I'm just going to go right underneath it, because Ohtani's like a unicorn. So,
yes,
the only domino that I think that's really out there is Blake Snell. Like, he's the top of the pitching market, and maybe there's a couple names behind him that are waiting for Blake Snell to get a deal so they can get 75% of the Blake Snell deal or something like that.
It's budget though for teams. Like teams that are in on Ohtani, teams that are in on Yamamoto, right?
I'm not gonna sign Cody Bellinger for $150 million if I might have to, you know, put $450 out there for Ohtani.
Right. And so, and even if, as you said, like let's say there's only five real teams interested in Ohtani. Well, what did Joe Wolf say, Yamamoto's agent, that half of the league is interested in him? So if you think you have a chance at Yamamoto, then you're not going after Blake Snell. Blake Snell is waiting, as you're right.
Right.
And then you keep going down the tier. Like, why would Eduardo Rodriguez sign?
Right. So Eduardo Rodriguez definitely waiting like for Blake
you
Snell
kind of
to
look
sign
a little
and
bit
for Yamamoto to sign. Yeah. There are some dominoes there. And if Yamamoto is going after the winter meetings, then Yeah, that there could be. But trades are still on the table. I was trying to think of some crazy trades for a radio appearance I just did, and I came up with Randy Arozarena. Just because the Rays always, I don't know, I think they always trade a guy like, you know, there's like surprise trades like that. Willie Adames, you know, in that sort of range where it's like, oh, you know, that's a surprising thing where they reloaded. Everyone's like looking at Glass now, but what if they also traded Randy Arozarena? I think that the Orioles are set up for a surprise trade. You know, could they be the Dylan Cease landing spot if they just finally give up one of their, you know, young bats?
Yes. So. Yes. Yeah. To me, they scream trade because if, I mean, yes, they have a lot of money to spend. It would be better if they spent the money and held on to their guys, but they have so many guys that they kind of are going to reach a point where they need to trade some
of
them.
Where do you play Joey Ortiz, Jordan Westberg, you know, Ramon Urias, Gunnar Henderson, and Jackson Holliday on the same infield?
This is the exact
conversation I have with Mike Elias. And he said, well, it all works out. It's like, if you trade them.
Yeah, right.
Right. Like, yes. Like that is such a vague response that it all works out means there's stuff we're going to do. People get hurt. Trades happen. Players underperform.
Utility guy.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff in between. I do think the trade market could heat up before the big free agents go. And I think it's because teams get a sense eventually internally of, are we actually in on these tip-top guys? Are we close with Snell? Are we close with Yamamoto? No, okay, let's move on to plan B. A team like Baltimore, they seem so unlikely to go splash for an elite pitcher in free agency because of the overall outlay compared to making a trade, right? If you trade for Dylan Cease, you don't have to extend him, right? You trade for Corbin Burns or Tyler Glasnow or any of the pitchers that we talk about as likely to be moved pitchers, that's a much smaller addition to your payroll because you're not talking about 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the road. You're really talking about this year and next year in many of those cases. So I think that's where we're headed. But the other place we're likely going to see players coming from are the non like top 15 free agents. Will Salmon and I talked about the top 15 names last week, trying to find fits for all those players. I thought today we'd each talk about a few players that we see beyond that group and try and find fits for some of those players as well. So, Britt, I'll throw this one to you first. Outside of the top 15 free agents, we had a great roundtable free agent rankings that went up on the site last week. Who do you like as a possible undervalued player that could be a great fit in free agency with a new club?
Okay, I'm going to go Lucas Giolito, who I think is probably in that just outside of the 15, kind of a second tier guy. You look at the ERA, you look at what he was able to do last year, not great, but this is a guy who got Cy Young votes from, I want to say, 19 to 21, 3 years in a row. I think if you're a team that's studying his delivery and his repertoire and you think you can fix him, he's somebody who I would put in that low risk, high reward. It's not going to take a whole lot of money. You know, you don't have the money for a Snell or Yamamoto, but I think he's a guy that's enticing. If you're trying to fill out a rotation, I think a lot of teams are going to be looking at someone like that.
One thing I like about Giolito is that you're likely to get innings. I mean, look at what he's done the last three seasons, over 160 each year, getting up to 184 and a third in 2023. I know the results haven't been there in 2 years running. In 2022, there was one particularly bad start. I think he had the Patriots Day start in Boston, that really early start time. That did some damage on his ratios. It wasn't just that. But I do like him as a solid bounce back target. I think where he signs is going to really give me a great deal of confidence if it's the Dodgers, the Rays, or a team that we'd like to handle pitching correctly. There's a related question I have for Eno. One thing that's been sort of different about Giolito these last two seasons compared to that window from 2019 to 2021 when he was getting those Cy votes has been contact inside the strike zone. He's been a lot more hittable inside the zone. And I'm wondering if there's anything that he's lost in terms of velo or movement or something in the arsenal that's been notably different that maybe has caused him to be more hittable inside the strike zone.
Yeah. And he's 29. So he's not super old where he's like 32, 33. And you're like, well, maybe this is just the decline of his arm. I think there's reason to believe on a 1 year deal, maybe even with an option attached to it, that you could kind of find lightning in a bottle here for another season or two.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it is. I do know that when he was getting those Cy Young votes, he was sitting 94 plus with the fastball, and now he's 93 minus. So, you know, sometimes one tick can make a big difference. Also, there's been some change to the fastball movement, and it's gotten less horizontal movement, which is not something you don't really care about with a four seam, but he has a straight change. He has a really unique pitch in the game of baseball. It's not unique as in it's the only one, but it's a rare pitch. The straight change is a change that has almost the same movement as your fastball, but a large velocity gap. And so you got a 12 mile an hour velocity gap. So any change in his fastball movement profile is going to be a big deal, because maybe hitters can see the changeup, and because it's more different than his four seam. And so what I've seen over the course of last year, when he went to different teams and they each had a new philosophy, each of them told him to throw his changeup more. So over the course of the season, he threw his fastball less and less, and he threw his changeup more and more, and he got beat around more and more. So I think the key is the fastball. And the thing that would make me nervous is that I feel like fastballs are the hardest thing to change. The fastball is your foundation as a pitcher. It's everything that you start off with. Everything comes off of that. And so the real work with Lucas Giolito is going to be on that fastball in order to get, you know, everything back in shape. But the good news is that if you do sign him, you get more time. So if you think about the Angels and the Guardians who got him last year, you got 3 days before the next start. Like, there was no like, you know, oh, let's, you know, take a step back and not throw for a week, or, you know, just work on fastball pitch design for a week. You know, you can't do that in the middle of the season. So I do think that there's potential here, and potential that I think he's going to want to do a 1 year bounce back deal or a one with an option. And puts you in the bucket that the Giants love you, the Dodgers love you, you know, even the Rays will talk to you. Like, you know, anybody who's willing to sign an option or a 1 year deal to try to bounce back has tons of places they can go. And I think tons of potential fits. And, you know, I think it's a good name to highlight.
Yeah, I think even the Orioles, the Twins, a couple other teams that have been pretty desperate for pitching could look here and find quite a bit of value in Lucas Giolito. How about one from you, Eno?
I've got one that I've gone up and down on. I'm the king of waffles, so I'm both in and out on this guy that I'm about to give you. it all depends on the actual numbers.
Eno would be a great GM. I like this guy, but I don't.
Yeah, it all depends on the numbers, because if he comes over and gets $60-70 million, I don't know if I love Jung-Hoo Lee that much. He's a player who's coming over from Japan. And what I do like is possible center field defense. We don't know 100% because he had average-ish center field defense before he had a kind of a massive ankle injury. And so we're kind of hoping that he has a center field defense. Really great contact profile that will remind you of Stephen Kwan and, you know, some other names, maybe even Luis Arraez, if he, you know, has that magic, you know, singles ability that Arraez has, you know, but generally a really high contact player. I got his batted ball stats, though, from Japan, from Korea, and he has less power than Ha-Seong Kim. So if you have less power than Ha-Seong Kim, only five regulars this year, above average regulars this year, had less power than Ha-Seong Kim. So, you know, he really needs to have center field defense and contact ability, which is why I would hope that the contract would not be a huge one, because there is risk in this profile. And so I have two comps for you. One comp is Luis Matos. That's on the sort of bad end for it, I think, because Luis Matos, I think, has shown that he's not necessarily a center fielder. And I don't know if he has the hit tool to kind of be Stephen Kwan. Stephen Kwan is a possible comp, but the real best comp is Brendan Donovan. And if you had an outfield version of Brendan Donovan, I think that's who Jung-Hoo Lee is. And so that is not a superstar, but it is someone who could help. And I think the teams that are most likely to help are teams that were bad at strikeout rate last year and may have a need in center field. Teams that come to mind are the Twins, the Yankees, and yes, even the Giants, even though they have Luis Matos on the team. All three of those teams are contenders that need help in center, need help in strikeout rate, and you know, have the resources to do it. Some of those teams, the Giants, have been linked to Jung-Hoo Lee, so that's an intriguing bat for me. I mean, if it is just Brandon Donovan, and you get an average-ish center fielder with the great hit tool, if you get him for like $30 million over three or something like that, or you know, a decent price, then that's a real bonus, especially outside of the top 15.
Yeah, I know you tweeted about some of those batted ball metrics earlier in the day on Wednesday, and one thing that really stood out to me is that because the strikeout rate is so low, the comparison was between Jung-Hoo Lee and Ha-Sung Kim, because I think when you look at players coming from the KBO, you want to kind of compare apples to apples for competition purposes.
They were on the same team, same park, a lot of the same competition.
Yeah, and because of the injuries in 23, it made sense to go back a year. The problem with any player with an extremely low strikeout rate, this is a good problem to have, of course, is that your exit velocity metrics, the average exit velocity, especially hard hit rates, all those things, they get reduced because all the balls you put in play that you don't hit hard as a result of not striking out are baked into that. So it's one of those situations where if we had a little more information, if we had the best speed, if we had the top 50% of his batted balls, if we knew how hard he was hitting those, that might give us a little more of an indicator of how he stacks up to Kim from a power perspective, because the strikeout rate is significantly lower, right? I mean, it is absurd. 5.9% K rate last year, 5.1% in 2022. And again, keeping the Kim comparison, Kim's K rates weren't bad. Kim's K rates, I think, were in the low 10, 12% rate. So it's not like you're comparing him to a totally different skill set, but it's still just one notch different. Really interesting player, fits a lot of places, might be a center fielder at first who moves to a corner by the time a multi-year deal ends, but I think this could end up being a nice signing as well.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I want to throw Luis Severino's name into the ring. We've talked about him on a handful of occasions. I mean, injuries are a huge part of the story for him. But the thing that I can't get away from, Eno's pitching model, even in the struggles, pointed to a guy that really had not lost a lot of stuff. And when you'd watch him, you're like, yeah, it just seems like mistakes being punished. That happens at Yankee Stadium. He's dealt with that home park his entire career. I think when he struggles, you see that home run rate spike, and it spiked worse than ever in 2023. So if you just take Luis Severino and get him out of Yankee Stadium and put him in a neutral park, that makes him better. If you put him in a pitcher-friendly park, that would make him better. If you put him in an organization that's good at tweaking pitchers, that could make him better. He's healthy right now, coming off the oblique injury that was slowing him down at the end of the season. So I could see this being another guy, much like Giolito, where maybe it's a one-year deal because the possibility of cashing in with a big four-year deal this time next year is absolutely out there. When he's been good, you're talking about someone who could be a five war pitcher. I think just about any team in need of pitching could be in the market here. So maybe injury risk tolerance is the one box you have to tick and say, which teams take chances there? The Dodgers do, the Rangers do, the Rays do, the Giants do. Yeah. So I think Severino's the kind of guy you can get on a one-year deal. Maybe it's 15, 20 million. It actually doesn't even really matter that much because it's only a one-year deal. And I think you can get him and it doesn't change your plans at the top of the market. So maybe he's one of those guys that we see find a new home.
Exactly. He's in the Lance Lynn bucket, but he's better than Lance Lynn.
He probably has more suitors than Lance Lynn.
Yeah, he's so, so interesting because you're right. Like in New York, it was always like, well, if Severino's healthy, you know, and that was just always, mm-hmm. it was never a question of talent or ability or stuff. It was just, if he's healthy, then we're good. Then he's going to be good. Then we've got this, you know? So I think if you're a team that feels confident that you can keep him healthy, and again, like you said, DBR, you're not saddling yourself to like a 4 or 5 year deal. You're just using this guy who also is going to be intrigued with a short deal to reset his market a little bit, reestablish his value. This is a win-win. I'd be shocked if there weren't like double digit teams that are in on a guy like Severino, because it's a total no-brainer. Like even if you're a team like the Orioles, like you could do that and still get a Dylan Cease and still make a trade. And oh my God, wow, look at this rotation now, right? Like this to me has just almost no downside. This is a really good pick by you.
I almost feel bad for the Yankees because there are people on the free agent market that are former Yankees that didn't work out in New York that everyone's going to be interested in. I mean, Harrison Bader, Frankie Montas, Jordan Montgomery is going to sign for big money this year. And Luis Severino are all players that, you know, at the right price, anybody should be in on them. I almost feel like the Yankees are not in on them, almost because if you came to that fan base and said, yes, we fixed the Yankees, it's good, they're going to be better this year. We signed Bader on a one-year deal and Severino on a one-year deal and Montas is back. The fan base would be like, what? We riot.
I don't know if there's a group of fans in every fan base that are like this, but I can't believe there's even pushback at all among Yankees fans on Twitter about the idea of them acquiring Juan Soto. If you don't want Juan Soto on your team, you are a bozo.
Yeah.
A capital B bozo.
I hope that's the part they clip out of this podcast.
Oh boy.
Juan Soto will make any team better. Clearly, if you're the Yankees, yes, you want Juan Soto. No, you're not really worried about what it costs you because, relatively speaking, the impact he makes in 2024 compared to what you're going to give up via trade almost certainly works out in a way that makes your team a lot better,
yes.
Even if it's only for 1 year, even if he doesn't sign an extension to stay there for 10 more years.
I have a tiny riff on the Juan Soto situation. I agree with you, Derek. You're a bozo if you don't think the Juan Soto is making you better. One. Two, I see all these teams saying, well, I only want him if we extend him. That ain't happening either. Put that in your little pipe dream and go smoking on a bridge. Not happening. The guy gave up $440 million in DC. He's now on the precipice of choosing his next destination, and he's going to throw all that away. By the way, his agent is Scott Boras. Like, I think not. Teams need to think of this guy as what he is, which is a one-year rental. Now, maybe if he likes New York, that gives them an advantage to re-sign him when he hits the market. But guys, I will like bet my house that they're just not going to extend Juan Soto unless the team throws crazy money at him, which they're not going to do. They're going to
without knowing what their competition is, and
so it just makes absolutely no sense. Now, I also saw a report it would take two top 100 prospects to get a Juan Soto. I also push back against that because if I'm the Padres, I don't need your top prospects. I mean, I do because
I need people to play now.
I need pitchers now. They have lost so many pitchers that they have. I think Ken Rosenthal brought this up on his podcast. They have 700 innings to cover. So these two top 100 prospects, that's nice, but they need pitchers now. They're in win now mode, even though they're shedding salary. They're still probably going to be about $200 million. So take your little top prospects and go package them elsewhere. I think this is going to require actual big leagues pitching, which is going to be tough. It's going to be a little bit of a tougher sell. So that is my riff. I am just already irritated by the Juan Soto like misinformation and the stuff that's been flying around. Juan Soto wants control over where he plays for a long time after next year. He's not going to give that up because it'll make it easier for the Padres to trade him. Like, just not happening.
Yeah, there's no reason for him to care about that. How about a second free agent value from you, Britt? Anybody else that really catches your eye outside that top 15 that you could see making a big impact in 2024 and beyond?
So I was looking at this, guys, and like, honestly, when you look at all this and you kind of get down here, it's like, not really. I mean, I like Jameer Candelario. I think he's a guy who was the top, like one of the top bats available this year on the market. Is he a game changer? No. Are the bats really thin in this class? Yes. Mm-hmm. So should you take a look at a guy like that, who I think is very versatile in that he can play second, he can play third. You know, he has the ability to hit for power. I think he's a guy that is going to, this is a great time to be a free agent bat because, mm-hmm. like I said, it's a thin class. So do I think he's a good value? Yeah, I think he's not going to break the bank. I think he's going to be a solid upgrade for a lot of teams, you know, that need a bat, that need a guy who can, you know, hold his own defensively at a couple different spots, is a little flexible. So I put him in that good value like category. But honestly, guys, I was like rifling through and some of these, and like there's not a whole lot this year, which is why I think you mentioned this, DVR. I expect like trades. I expect trades on trades on trades this year, because the next year, the class that's coming looks really good. So I think a lot of teams are going to be like, well, let's save this budget. Let's earmark this, which is kind of what the Dodgers have done, we think, for Shohei Ohtani, right? So I think you're going to see a lot of trades this year. But if you are looking for like a cheaper bat who's still pretty good, I think he's probably belongs in the top 30 free agents, then I would look at a guy like Candy.
Yeah, I think he makes a lot of sense. I actually think Candelario's market is loosely connected to that of Matt Chapman. It might take Matt Chapman signing first before Candelario and his agent decide, okay, we're going here, just because of the lack of depth that you mentioned. And I think there's a handful of teams that actually need third baseman. Not everyone can have Chapman. I like that fit from an offensive perspective as well. We already saw one trade, Eugenio Suarez getting flipped to Arizona. You know, and I talked about that a bit on Rates and Barrels too. So it could be a few more moves like that that unfold as teams try and fill in similar needs. How about a second one from you, you know?
I'm going to cheat and give you two names.
Why do I even make rules? There's no structure here.
Do you like both these guys, or do you also dislike both these?
You're just hedging. You need three chances.
This is a different kind of hedge. This is a different kind of hedge. I'm not going to say that I don't like these guys. I'm just going to hedge by giving you multiple names. I do think that they are similar in that Jordan Hicks and Seth Lugo are not the top of the market right now. They are not the top free agent starter or the top free agent reliever on the market, I don't think. And so, because you got Hader out there. So it's pretty obvious that they're like the next guys, right?
Yeah.
But for me, Seth Lugo has a lot in common with Sonny Gray. He's got two good breaking balls. The fastballs are good enough. You know, you got some concern with innings, but so you did with Sonny Gray. And so, you know, if you can get Seth Lugo for less than $375, which I think you will, then you got Sonny Gray for a discount price. And, the guy that I see when I look at Jordan Hicks is, it's not immediately, obvious that it's sort of like a Brusdar Graterol, like a very good sinker, like very high sinker that doesn't strike out as many guys, but could be my closer and would be an awesome setup guy. So for a rich team, he's a setup guy. For a poor team, he's a good closer. And I don't think he's going to cost at the top of the market. So it's almost like the B is almost as good as A, and he's going to cost me a lot less. So I like those guys. As for Fitz, you know, I think he would be kind of amazing. Him and Seawald, like, probably would be the most different in terms of looks at the end of a, like, Hicks is going to come out here throwing 100 like sinker, and Seawald's going to do 92 with that little, I don't even know how to describe that fastball. So, you know, that would be, and Arizona really needs some bullpen help. So, I think Hicks would be pretty awesome there, but in general, everybody wants bullpen help. So you can put Hicks anywhere, you know, especially for, like I said, a rich team could just make him their setup guy. And then Seth Lugo, again, fit everywhere because, you know, he's not going to break the bank and he can give you innings. I think he's going to give you at least 125 next year, maybe 150. And with a breaking ball like that, I think he's pretty like safe as a starting pitcher. I know that people are like, oh, he was just in the bullpen and stuff, but like a plus breaking ball seems like a really good foundation for a starting pitcher. And then you have two of them. Like I'm pretty good with that.
Yeah, I like Lugo quite a bit too for all the reasons you mentioned. The only thing I've noticed in his profile, he gets hit in the zone a lot, especially
his
as a starter.
Aren't amazing.
Yeah, so I wonder.
Someone's given him 3 years, though.
I think so. I think it, and I think the being the fallback being a good high leverage late inning reliever is a nice floor.
That too. Right? Like
if it just completely unravels as a starter, if it just doesn't work and he's your seventh inning guy at 9, 10, whatever million per year, that's fine. You can live with that, especially if you're a good team. So I think Seth Lugo still makes a lot of sense. And he was a great guy I'd sort of forgotten about going to 2023 when he popped up early in the season in the Padres rotation. It was like, oh yeah, Seth Lugo. We used to really like him as a possible starter for the Mets. So I think his market's going to be fun to watch develop here in the next couple of weeks. I submit to you one more name, Mitch Garver. And I don't think you want to sign Mitch Garver as a catcher. I think Mitch Garver is a good enough hitter. And I think in a world with universal DH now, you sign him with no real plans to use him as a catcher. Maybe the ability to use him if you have some organizational depth problems in season, right? You lose your top two catchers to significant injuries, then okay, Mitch Garver becomes part of your catching plan again. This is a guy who was 83rd percentile in barrel rate last season. He's got a great eye. It was a 98th percentile chase rate. I think you're talking about like a 125, 130 WRC plus bat. And I think using him as a DH keeps him healthy. So if you can get 450, maybe 500 plate appearances from Mitch Garver, he's a few years younger than JD Martinez. I think he can actually be an impact bat that a smaller team that needs an impact bat but can't afford to pay up in a thin market, he could actually be a great fit. I think I saw Tim Britton listed some possible teams on that roundtable that I mentioned before. I think the Rays were one of the teams that came up, the Marlins. I could see a ton of teams being interested in Garver, given the relative cost and given that people might be overlooking the quality of hitter he is around all the time he's lost to injuries in recent years.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. That's a good pick. It's not somebody that really jumped off the page, but you made a compelling argument. So now I am sold.
Do you think he's a catcher?
I think he's like a more of an emergency catcher. Like I think look at him as a DH and you'd actually be pretty surprised. Now, I think the other part about fit for a player like this is you need to be pretty deep and athletic and versatile everywhere else if you're going to sign someone who's predominantly a DH. Like there's a roster construction element to having a player like Mitch Garver, but that he has the ability to catch if needed makes him a little more of a fit than JD, you want to throw JD Martinez in the outfield ever? I know the Dodgers did it sometimes, but
what about
that's not a good idea.
That's a good point. Also, I've heard that Mitch Garver is like a terrific, terrific clubhouse presence, which doesn't make people sign people, but it's certainly like when you're looking at pros and cons, it certainly belongs on the pros list. So, he's a guy who I think is very well liked in clubhouses, is a very good presence. So I think that asshole could factor into things as well.
I'm looking at the Diamondbacks and Mariners. They're bottom five in DH production, projected DH production. And the players that I'm seeing there don't have to be DHs, number one guy on the depth chart for the Mariners is Dominic Canzone. That's not a great DH situation. And for the Diamondbacks, number one is Emmanuel Rivera. They could put a DH and both of those teams, like the Diamondbacks have built in flexibility with Jordan Lawler and Geraldo Perdomo on the same team. And the Mariners have kind of tried to build a team that's fairly versatile. So, I think both those teams kind of fit a Mitch Garver.
Yeah. Love that the Brit had the clubhouse information too. I think that always rounds a player up value-wise in the eyes of people doing the evaluations when they have to make a final call. And is this guy going to be a good fit for us? Yeah, actually he will be. So there's a few values that we've got. Maybe there'll be a few others that actually help. Once we know the numbers, that certainly helps. But sort of basing it off of projections and some of the things that we're expecting to happen, there's a seven. I was only thinking we're going to get six. Seven different
snuck one in
values. that in and of itself is,
why do we make rules?
Why even bother? When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way.
Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk Hall of Fame. Class of 2024 ballots are out, and a lot of different ways we could slice this one, but I thought we should start with Joe Mauer and whether or not he actually has a strong case, and how you sort of look back at the career he had, you know, the injuries and moving out from behind the plate. And when you look back at Joe Mauer's career, you know, what kind of lens are you looking through, and how do you sort of grade him against other players in the Hall of Fame, given the complications with the injuries and the defensive position switch?
Yeah, the switch is difficult for me because you can say something like Joe Mauer, I believe, is one of one the catchers that's won the batting title, or it's a very small number of hitters that have won the batting title and while catching. And then you can look at the wins above replacement over at Fangraphs, 15th most among catchers all time. And you know, you can look at the bat and he fits all time right next to Yogi Berra and Jorge Posada in terms of his league and park adjusted offense, WRC plus. So like, he fits in a lot of ways, but the position switch makes you a little bit wary of like just listing all of his numbers as a catcher. You know, guys above him that are Hall of Famers, you know, that have more war were catchers all the way through. Yadier Molina's above him, Buster Posey, Joe Torre, you know, Mike Piazza did some DHing, but it was at the very end. Most of these guys that are above him caught their entire careers. Joe Mauer was like more of a 60-40 split. You know, I think once you factor in the defensive abilities while he was a catcher, you know, he was a good catcher. And then you think he wasn't moved off of catcher because he was bad defensively. He was kind of moved off of catcher because of the concussions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so is it like, you know, put him in another era and nobody even knows really that concussions are bad. And they're just like, oh, you got loopy old catcher disease.
Yeah. I mean, he would have caught a few more years and would be probably paying a price for it already.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah, it's so interesting because to me, he catches for 10 seasons. And there's no question if you look at those 10 seasons as catcher that he's a Hall of Famer. There's no question. You look at those stats, you're like, these are Hall of Fame stats. Then he makes the position change. And you're right. All of a sudden, it's like, well, is he now the Hall of Very Good because of how things ended? But I think that he's had enough because he played 10 seasons as catcher. It wasn't like he had two or three and then they moved him. I think he played enough and had enough of a sample size where he was playing at that Hall of Fame caliber that he shouldn't be penalized for being moved off that position unless the play. I think he still gets in. I think he still deserves to be in. Now, he is definitely like a fringe case, and I think you can make the argument for and you can make the argument against. But to me, I look at those 10 seasons he had behind the plate, and I think this is a Hall of Fame guy.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it. Yeah.
It's incredible. Six All-Star game selections, 5 silver sluggers, I think 3 gold gloves, 1 MVP win, another top 5 finish back in 2008. Strange in some ways, because even the era in which he played, you would have expected Joe Mauer. Look at the home run column, 143 home runs. How many players do we talk about having a legitimate case as Hall of Famers having that little in the power department? Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show how good everything else looks. But I think that's something people might get kind of stuck on when they look at his case. And the main reason I brought him up, I think every time we talk about the Hall of Fame, I point people to Jay Jaffe's great work with the JAWS system. I just think it's an easier way to contextualize what players did in their career. That's why I appreciate all the effort Jay has put into that over the years. When you look through the JAWS system, a 39 WAR 7-year peak is better than the average Hall of Fame catcher. There's 16 catchers in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
That's a better peak. It's also a better career. 55 WAR compared to 53 for the average Hall of Fame catcher. So the fringe cases are the toughest cases. I think everyone wants to keep raising the bar. And it's like, well, did we set the bar in the right place in the last 50 years while building the Hall of Fame? Is the bar where it needs to be or not? I think that's part of the conversation, too, with players that are kind of on the borderline that are going to pop up on the ballots from really now until forever.
He might have an easier time if he was like the other name that doesn't have a lot of homers and that I think is a Hall of Famer that some people may debate me is Buster Posey. He has 158 homers. And that's a little bit because Buster Posey has fewer games and he'll be one of the fewest games. He will be the fewest games among catchers to be elected in the Hall of Fame. But the thing that Buster Posey has is rings, you know, you know, Mauer lacks a little bit on that secondhand thing. So I don't think the batting titles are a huge deal, but it is kind of cool. And I've got the thing now. It's always good when you've done something that no one has done since somebody named Bubbles. So Joe Mauer is the only American League backs full-time catcher to win the batting title, and he did it three times. And he's the first since Eugene Bubbles Hargrave and Ernie Lombardi, who had two. So he's got the most batting titles among catchers, and that's really part of his argument is the stick in terms of singles and just hitting. And you know, to have a season like 2009 where he hit 365, you know, but also the other years, where, you know, he ends up with a 306 batting average for his career as not full-time catcher. I know, but he gets my vote. Buster Posey gets my vote. The hardest thing for me here, and I just really want to get, Britt's opinion on this, because I don't think your vote's coming. So you don't have to.
Okay. Don't even get me started on the rant with the Hall of Fame voting system.
I know, but you'll get it and you'll have to deal with this someday. And
should already have had to deal with it. I've been covering baseball for 15 years.
I know. But the biggest source of vitriol out there, you get yelled at, like, I voted for Bobby Abreu. That's a kind of a fringe case. And people get mad when they're like, that's a Hall of really good. I was a big Scott Rolen defender. I actually thought Scott Rolen was a Hall of Famer when I watched him, because I remember watching him as a younger person. Yeah. So, you know, I thought that even during his career, but other people didn't. That's fine. The other thing that gets people the most angry, of course, is steroids. And so, Yes. Alex Rodriguez. But this is the thing that made the people most angry last year. I voted for Gary Sheffield and didn't vote for Alex Rodriguez and Manny Ramirez. So those three, where do you stand on those three?
Ooh, I'm out.
On all of them?
I'm out on, because, you know, here's the thing. I think Alex Rodriguez was probably a Hall of Fame player without the steroids. Probably. I think you can make the case that probably, but we don't know. That is also a question. And also, while we're at it, just because you're a great player doesn't mean you're guaranteed to be in the Hall of Fame. I've long said this. Barry Bonds belongs in the Hall of Fame. Okay. Whether you believe he juiced or not, he's probably still a Hall of Famer. But one, he's got the whole steroid issue. And two, he wasn't nice to the media. Let's not forget, David Ortiz had a steroid issue. David Ortiz was on the Mitchell list. But David Ortiz is very nice to the media, has been a friendly guy his whole career. And that matters because the media are the people voting. And they will hold it against you.
Good reason.
It is. No, let's be real. If David Ortiz acted like Barry Bonds, if he had the same persona his career as Barry Bonds, would it have been as celebrated when Big Papi got into the Hall of Fame? Would he have as many votes? I don't think so. And as you mentioned, I'm not a voter, so I can say what I want here. Yeah. I'm not part of this. For those who are not aware, they did not recognize MLB.com reporters for a very long time. So my early years in MLB.com didn't count. They finally agreed that they did. They don't grandfather it in. They just reset the whole thing. So I am not a Hall of Fame voter, but I think that that matters. It matters because it's for the same reason that when a guy is mean to you versus nice to you, you may take it easy on him in a column. You may give him the benefit of the doubt, right? This is what we're talking about. And you look at those guys.
A great argument for media relations ability for players. They should be listening to you. Your interactions with the media matter.
Do you think, though, if Barry Bonds was this media darling, do you think he'd still not be in?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the David Ortiz thing is a head scratcher for sure. And I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't help me as a voter because I don't want to make that a rule. You know, I don't want to be like, oh, yeah, well, he was nice to me. Vote. What I've
it's
tried
just
to
do. It's a subconscious thing.
No, it definitely is. And maybe I'm just trying to make excuses for not voting for A-Rod and voting for Gary because I liked him as a kid too. Like some of that's just like, oh, I liked him. I liked him when I watched him play, you know? The thing that I've been trying to do is just set the year that they had an actual testing policy and be like, that's before that, I believe that baseball was complicit in steroid usage in a way by looking the other way. And so they, even though, yes, steroids are illegal, blah, 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 like they looked the other way. They didn't test for it. And so they left the sort of the door open for it. And so I don't really, I think that I like, hey, we're going to put the commissioner at the time of the steroid the era into the Hall of Fame and not the players that played for him that did things that he allowed them to do. So that's why Gary Sheffield gets my vote and Manny and A-Rod don't. It might be random, but that, you know, Manny and A-Rod got in trouble after there was a steroid policy. They quote unquote knew what they were getting into. Whereas Gary's story is he had no idea what it was and he did it before the 2004 cutoff. And, you know, I know it could just be a story, but but he didn't fail a test and he didn't get in trouble for anything that happened after there was a steroid policy. So that's been my line in the sand.
All right. I'll leave that alone and let people.
That's a minefield.
People will just be wondering how, you know, where's DVR in this? DVR is just going to say one last thing. Adrian Beltre is actually unanimous. A lock for the Hall of Fame.
He better be unanimous. Come on. Don't be that jerk and vote for Adrian Beltre.
No, there's going to be someone who just unanimous. Says he's not a first ballot. So he'll get in on the first ballot.
Bozo was making some of these votes. I don't have a vote, but some of these people voting don't even cover baseball anymore.
Well, they'll be like, he didn't get to 500 homers, so he doesn't get my vote on the first ballot.
He's definitely a Hall of Famer.
Irrelevant.
not even a debate. Adrian Beltre of the first timers on the ballot, easily a Hall of Famer. One of the easiest cases that you're going to see on the 2024 ballot. But we are going to sign off and we'll be back from Nashville making all sorts of good stuff. So be sure to follow this show. If you haven't done so already, hit the YouTube subscribe button. We really appreciate everybody who's already done that. Be sure to do it if you haven't. You can find us on Twitter at Unoceras, at Britt Jiroli, at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of 3-0 Show. We're back with you next week.
Always got the green light here.
Green light 3-0, and she's gone.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.